House Labor and Commerce will now come to order at 3:17. With us today are Representative Gabrielle Ledoux, Representative Mark Newman, Representative Jay Ramirez, and Representative Berger Gardner, and myself, Representative Olson. First item on the agenda today is House Bill 205, Real Estate Broker Salespersons. With us we have at least Dave Beacon. Come on up, Dave, please. Could you keep this under 2 hours?
Very much under 2 hours.
Please identify yourself for the record and your affiliation.
My name is Dave Feakin, and I am here representing the 1,600 members of the Alaska Association of Realtors. House Bill 205 is a modernization of existing statutes related to real estate brokerage, addressing issues of education of real estate licensees and the supervision relationship between brokers and licensees. The real estate industry is a dramatically changing industry. In regard to Section 2 of the CS version, the current requirements of 20 hours of pre-licensing education is 20-year-old law. 20 years ago, brokers controlled the information through the MLS. Now there's the World Wide Web. Nearly 80% of the current buyers use the web for their property searches. 20 years ago, there was no home inspections. There was a couple of loan programs available from Alaska Housing. Those have been replaced, or added to, actually, by hundreds from all across the country. There was no concerns about wetland maps, no required disclosure of property condition, no predatory lending issues. No one knew that mold endangered your mental capacity. You didn't have to prove that the property was not in a 100-year floodplain. You didn't have to know which municipalities were part of the national flood insurance programs and which ones were not. There was no disclosure of violent crimes, and there was no subprime lending issues. The Real Estate Commission has continued to increase the required course material pre-licensing education, but the number of hours has not increased. This bill increases the required hours from 20 to 40 hours of education prior to taking a licensing exam. At 20 hours, Alaska is the lowest in the country. At 40 hours, Alaska will still be the lowest in the country. Additionally, the required topics of post-licensing education need an increase from 20 to 30 hours in post-licensing education to adequately teach the required materials. The Alaska Association of Realtors supports an increase in hours versus a reduction in course material to meet the public's need for competent real estate practitioners. Regarding Section 1, Realtors also recommends clarification of the issue of issuing a license to persons convicted of felons. Current law is unclear as to the time elapsed since the completion of a sentence for these crimes. This bill will clarify and standardize the 7 years as is required with brokers and associate brokers' licenses and give the Commission the language needed to protect the public from people convicted of felonies. Regarding Section 4, this is an issue of residency of the broker. It is addressing the issue of supervision of licensees. Alaska law allows remote supervision of licensees. The intent of the original legislation was to allow a licensee, not a broker, to do business in remote Alaska under the supervision of a broker in a more populated area. As times have changed, some creative brokers have attempted to use remote supervision to allow a broker to own, operate, and manage multiple companies in different states. This simply states that an office in Alaska either not have licensees or that the office employ an associate broker to directly supervise those licensees. There appears to be some difficulties between legislative drafting and the Department of Law as to this language. I hope this clarifies the intent. The issue of multiple business operations, the issue of single broker owning, operating, and being employed by being employed by multiple corporations or partnerships is further clarified to require all of the business organizations to share a single physical address. Many brokerage firms are multiple companies for insurance and other reasons. An example would be a company that does property management and sales will separate these companies for errors and omissions reasons because the rate is considerably higher on property management companies. Regarding Section 9, statute has always said that a broker is responsible for the action of their licensees. But the Alaska Supreme Court ruled in the 80s that a broker is not responsible for conduct that they had no knowledge of. This requires the broker to have a written policy and procedures manual addressing the following issues. Number one, requiring the licensees to comply with all state law. Number two, requiring the real estate licensees to act fairly and honestly in all dealings. And number three, requiring real estate licensees to notify the broker, broker designee, of any legal disputes or allegations of wrongdoings from buyers, sellers, leasors, or lessees. And require real estate licensees to maintain regular communication with the broker and broker designee. This makes it the duty of the licensee to inform the broker, making them aware of issues that need supervision regarding the licensees complying with state law and their conduct with customers and clients. Additionally requiring these written policies and notification of supervision would hopefully solve a lot of complaints now that could be handled in a more cost-effective manner rather than the legal ramifications. In order to comply with the education hours, we're asking for an implementation date of February 1st, 2008, because that complies with the license renewal date. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
In my haste to get the meeting started, I failed to have the CS adopted, but I think we'll fix that right now.
Chair, I move CS for House Bill 205, Labor and Commerce, version 25, LS0684/M for committee referral.
Any questions for Mr. Feakin from the committee? Representative Gardner.
I'm not quite sure how to form this question, but as I read through the requirements under Section 6, most of which are really on page 3, it seems to me that a lot of the responsibility for good behavior, as identified in the broker's manual or policy thing, it seems like the responsibility is put on the real estate licensee. Like it's the licensee's responsibility to maintain communication with the broker. Is that kind of a shift of responsibility there?
Well, Mr. Chairman, because of the, it's always been the responsibility of the broker to supervise the licensee, but after that Supreme Court ruling in the 80s, it became a place where the broker had to know of this misconduct for the broker to be responsible for supervision. This clarifies it by putting it in writing, policy manual, the state requiring a policy manual between the broker and the licensee outlining those issues of supervision.
Did the chair follow up?
Follow.
So does that mean that if there is a lawsuit of some sort relating to this, the broker is covered, protected, on the basis that the licensee has failed to inform them?
Currently, yes. This would clarify that language, that the broker is to be supervising that. It also clarifies the issue of communication. Currently, a lot of brokers aren't aware of these lawsuits until they get served. When, if it was brought to their attention before that, a lot of these issues could be worked out, negotiated out.
Piece of real estate, piece of legislation is supported by the, you represent the
Last Association of Realtors.
Of Realtors. Are brokers in membership too?
Yes. Realtors is a trade organization, and its membership is comprised of all licensees, whether they're brokers or sales associates.
Can you tell me approximately what the ratio is of brokers to licensees in your membership?
Probably 25% are brokers, 75% are licensees, probably.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Feakin? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Beacon, I noticed on the CS a change in Section 2 for the applicant insured must complete 40 hours. The original bill said 30 hours, a change from original current statute of 20.
There's two areas of education. There's pre-licensing education, and that is changing from 20 to 40, and that is on page 3, section 2.
Yeah.
And then section 3 deals with post-licensing. Once you've obtained the license, you have a period of 12 months to complete. Currently it's 20, and that would go to 30.
Sure. For a pre-license, a person getting their education for a pre-license, what is the current average cost of that right now, and what will it go up to?
Currently the cost is $275. In Anchorage it's probably higher than that outside of Anchorage, but I'm from Kenai and I believe that's the same cost there. I'm not sure, I don't imagine that it would double, but I haven't had any quotes from instructors as to what they would change the price to.
Wonderful.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the Alaska Association of Realty recommend prices so that those are somewhat in line, or is it just...
No, it's a free market. In fact, it's... they don't recommend pricing. There are adequate instructors to meet the demand in most areas. In fact, it's not generally a very financially rewarding.
So the free enterprise system will work?
Works. It's generally a licensee within an area who's an active sales associate that puts on a class when there's a need for one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
We've got several people in the room that have signed up. I think we'll start with Ruth Blackwell. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Ruth Blackwell. I live in Juneau. I'm an associate broker, and I'm the professional standards chair for the Alaska Association of Realtors, and I'm also a certified instructor. I'm speaking in behalf of the education. I've been on the Real Estate Commission twice. The first time was when we implemented the education. At that point, we had a one-page earnest money agreement, no inspections. It took us 3 or 4 months to close a loan, and it was not anywhere close as complicated as it is now. Now we have all these other things to deal with. The 20 hours, I've talked with other instructors, and the Real Estate Commission keeps giving us things that we need to put in, and we know we need to put in to the curriculum. And 20 hours is just not enough time to get someone started. And as for the 30 hours, we've just gone through one section of that. It was 20. Now, we hope to have 30, because actually teaching it, we just don't have enough time to put in the amount of material we feel someone needs in the first year. It's just more complicated. And so that's why I'm here today, to urge you to support those two education parcels. Does anyone have any questions?
Thank you very much. Rick, you're in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rick Urian. I'm the director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, Department of Commerce. Yesterday, we had the privilege of having a very successful meeting with your staff and two previous speakers, and we come up with the proposed substitute that's before you today. And I would agree with the statements most of the statements you've already heard for testimony before me. There is one section, though, however, the Department of Law has a great problem with that we feel needs to be corrected in the bill. And that is the Section 7 of the proposed substitute on lines 17, where it says, notwithstanding A of this section, a person registered as a real estate broker under this chapter may reside out of state if the broker. This implies that somewhere in the real estate laws there's some residency requirement. There is no residency requirement in this law or any other licensing law, because the Constitution of the United States will not allow that. And this sets up a different provision for those who live outside of the state versus those who live in the state, and that's a protectionism that's not allowed by the Constitution. And you, if you want to make this as a requirement for supervision, you can do that, but you have to do it for in-state brokers as well as out-of-state brokers. I mean, there is no difference between a broker who takes a two-month vacation to Arizona and a broker who lives in Arizona. The Real Estate Commission has done a very good job of coming up with the ability to supervise remotely. And it was not done for remotely in Alaska. It was done for remotely outside of Alaska, where you are allowed to supervise by fax machine, by computer, by telephone, and all the modern day equipment that we have today. And so we would ask that you either delete that section or you modify it to pertain to both in-state and out-of-state brokers. And that's my testimony.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just, while you were looking at that, Rick, Mr. Erin, looking at the best way to go about doing that, and you could either add, you know, may reside out of state, or add the words in state, or just remove all of Section 7.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify? With that, I'll close it to the public and bring it back to the committee. And do I hear
Mr. Chair, I propose amendment number one, conceptual amendment number one, light page 6, lines 17 through 22, section 7, remove section 7 from
actually
CS for House Bill 205.
I've just been advised that our drafters say that we have the correct version in front of us, so I think what we'll do is we'll hold this bill over until we sort it out, but it appears that everybody's in agreement except our drafters. I think we'll just hold it over and fix it and bring it back to the committee next time.
I will withdraw my motion for now.
Thank you very much. I guess we're almost done. We've got two bills left, and I'm going to bring them up briefly at the same time and then move on to them one on one. They're both of them are related to the RCA. We have two committee substitutes that are out now. I was hoping they'd be done in time to get them out to everybody last night. We got them out first thing this morning, and I'm again hoping the RCA has had no opportunity to look at them. I think what we might do is take a 10-minute brief at ease to give you a chance to read both. Both of them are relatively short. One's a half a page. The other one, I think, is 4.5 pages. Both of them significantly change the original verbiage of each bill. And I apologize. I was hoping that we'd have them out 24 hours in advance. But I think that you'll see that there's some significant changes. So I think we'll take a brief at ease while the RCA takes a peek at them. Go back in. Although we're shy a couple people, but we've got a quorum. At this point in time, what we're going to do is I'm going to ask for a motion to bring up 205, the work draft that's currently before you, and I apologize. I was hoping it would have been before you earlier this morning as a working document for discussion purposes.
209.
209, I'm sorry.
Chair? I would like to move CS for House Bill 209, Labor and Commerce, version 25, LS0717/M for committee discussion.
And it's my intention today to have this be discussion purposes only, and it's limited to the RCA today. We're going to have open meetings for virtually everybody else. But again, I apologize about the shortness of getting this out to you. Ideally, we would have had it out a day or two ago, so you would add adequate time to read it. But I'd like to start out with Chairman Guyard and have her walk us through her process on your legislation. The I believe it was docket R0610, which was your insurance bill that came to the governor this year. How does that work? The rest of the committee probably doesn't know how you structure something like that. Could you walk us through it?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of Labor and Commerce, for providing RCA the opportunity to address the reauthorization of the RCA today and also have an opportunity to review CS for House Bill 209. As you are probably aware, the sunset for the RCA expires on June 30, 2007. Our legislative mandate is to set just and reasonable rates for public utilities and common carrier pipelines transporting natural gas and oil within the state of Alaska. Some of the very exciting opportunities that we've had in the last 4 years is to create a far more transparent, accountable, and regulatory commission that is easier for regulated entities to do business with. That has been our mandate. Part of that internal drive for change resulted in a process whereby the RCA began to reach out to the regulated pipeline carriers and utilities in the state of Alaska and involve them in our planning and regulatory activities, as well as the planning activities associated with any electronic filing or any new web-based initiatives. An outgrowth of that was also to involve the pipeline carriers and public utility and the members of the public at large, including ARP and the public advocate and ACPIRG, asking everyone what type of statutory changes should the RCA pursue in this legislative session. This was not the first time we did it. We very successfully did it 3 years ago and then 2 years ago. And as a result of that effort, the commission has approximately $2.2 million to develop brand new web-enabled electronic filing systems for every pipeline carrier and public utility in the state of Alaska. And we are well down the road on that project. So we saw that the cooperative effort not only gave us the opportunity to learn, but also empowered the public utilities and pipeline carriers to have a little bit of control over their own destiny as a regulated entity in the state of Alaska. This year, knowing that it was a reauthorization year for the RCA, we made a very aggressive agenda for statutory change. We knew that through restructuring our agency and talking with the pipeline and public utility carriers that we could make substantial change this year. But we cannot make that kind of change by ourselves. We needed your help. We work from a mandate, a legislative mandate that you've given us, and we could not go any further without, in many areas, without having statutory change. So we went through a public process in formal docket RO611 or RO610, and we sought comment from everyone. What would you like to change? How would you like us to improve? What would you like us to do differently? And how can we work together to come up with the statutory language that that provides that the vehicle for that kind of change? We did that. We completed our process on February 22nd. We voted some statutory changes, the commission as a whole, and I was rude not to introduce my other commissioners that are here today. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Please take some time and
thank you. Commissioner Harbor, Commissioner Johnson, Commissioner Price, and Commissioner Wilson are here with us today. And we five went through that process. We studied the proposals of the companies that came before us, and we created a packet, which we sent to the governor on February 22nd. And the intention of the governor at the time was to support, I believe, a bill to enact many of the changes that we had requested. And with the other quite important activity that the governor's office had, in the beginning of March, they determined that they were unable to pursue that second piece of legislation and asked us to work with the legislature to try to promote a second bill which would meet the needs of the pipeline carriers and public utilities in the state of Alaska. And we have been working with you. We've talked with you. We've talked with the public. Some people think that I've talked endlessly about the opportunity for change in Alaska. So I haven't had a significant amount of time, a few minutes, to look at House Bill 209. It does not reflect many of the changes that were included in RO610. It does address, however, the statutory timelines, which we're very excited about. We think that we are ready to implement new statutory timelines, shorten up some timelines, and so while there are several provisions that I haven't had a chance to study yet, I do believe that at least insofar as that's concerned, we're happy to see that moving forward. We think that's good for Alaska. Thank you.
Well, there was some confusion on my part. I have a copy of order number 5 in front of me, and the outline that was in order number 5 didn't match up with Senate Bill 16. There were significant changes to that that didn't appear to be addressed by the full commission in order number 5. And what I'm trying to get at is, am I missing information? Was there another series of meetings that where votes were taken or to come up with the verbiage that was in Senate Bill 16?
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 16, for those who haven't had an opportunity to read it yet, is a reauthorization of the RCA. It provides the RCA with a 6-year reauthorization period. And in addition, we sought, I as chairman, sought a provision which would require the RCA to have biannual audits every 2 years. The information that we publish in our annual report, which you each received a copy of, certain timeline information would and certain benchmark information would be audited by the legislative auditor and would enable the legislative auditor then to create a report to tell you how we're doing in meeting those statutory timelines and also meeting the benchmarks that the agency put in place. We proposed that to Senator Terrio, and Senator Terrio included it CRNA included it in their committee substitute, because the testimony was from the public was very positive that information audited every 2 years would provide a lot of feedback that perhaps had been missing in the past as to how we were doing. And it would give the legislature an opportunity to bring us in if things were reported by the legislative auditor that weren't going so well. So no, you're correct. That piece of the legislation was not included in RO 610, but came as a result of an effort to really make sure that the legislature had the information that they needed.
Well, I think what I'm getting at is the final paragraph in the transmittal letter dealt with salary issues. And if you bear with me, finally, we discussed the possibility of proposing increases in salary levels of our commissioners. While we did not propose any legislative reform to increase the commissioners' salaries, we suggested to the governor the legislative determination regarding the appropriate salary levels for the commissioners. In Senate Bill 16, it was much broader than what was in the transmittal letter as a result of our 06-10.
Mr. Chairman, contradicted. I apologize. Senate Bill 16 has only 2 or 3 sections which deal with the audit and with the time, the extension. There was not
No,
a
I'm
Senate
referring
Bill
to 16. The CS.
The CS for Senate Bill 16 really has no more provisions in it than those that I've described. I'm sure we can pull it.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, can I ask if we're going to discuss Senate Bill 16 and this letter that you have, if we could all?
Well, it leads into why we're going to be addressing these salaries. Ultimately, I would agree with the RCA that the salary issue needs to be.
I understand that, but we're having a conversation, and I know you referred to this before. I thought we would have copies of it, because if we're going to talk about the document that you have and another bill, I'd like to see what we're talking about.
Then we can hold up on that. The bill in front of you.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
On prior discussion and just testimony received by Ms. Geard. Ms. Geard, you talked about biannual audits. How often are you audited now? What process do you go through? I know that you generally come in front of the legislature yearly, I believe. So if you could go over that, and then I'm just going to ask another question while I'm here, is with the you stated that you have started an aggressive agenda for statutory change. What different changes did you have in that statutory agenda that you didn't have a year ago?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, the answer to your first question is the legislative audit audits the RCA every time we are up for sunset. So the legislative auditor is sitting here, and she last audited the RCA in 2003, the last time we were sunset. Our sunset review is up, and she just completed an audit in late 2006 for the 2007 sunset. The idea was that that's a four-year period of time between audits, and the RCA believes that it's appropriate that we have these kind of health checks more frequently and more reporting and communication back and forth with the legislature, and that's why we made the proposal for the two-year audits of the information that's published in the annual report. The second question was the changes that we proposed dealt with many aspects, statutory timelines. We proposed that they would be changed. We addressed the issue of the Attorney General that provides legal counsel to the RCA. We proposed increasing fines in the letter that we wrote to the governor. We proposed, perhaps some of the other commissioners could also recall, I don't have it in front of me, but we had a variety of changes. We proposed to add certain positions to the partially exempt to enable us to hire associate attorneys, for example, which we don't have authority to hire right now, or law clerks, which we also don't have authority to hire. Being quasi-judicial in nature, we really have made an effort to treat ourselves and treat the agency much more as a quasi-judicial body.
Yeah, quick follow-up. More of a statement, I guess, and maybe Ms. Garrett wants to react to it. It seems that the several times that you've been in front of me, either in CNRA or in Labor and Commerce, different committee meetings, the discussion has always gone to the fact that we're speeding up our timeline, we're being more efficient, we're more effective with our time, we're getting decisions out. It seems to be somewhat of a repetitive statement that we keep hearing. Are you just continually getting that much better all the time, or is it just a statement that we hear a lot?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I think that the commissioners sitting before you today have made a concerted effort to respond to the criticisms that occurred in the 2003 sunset, where we were not timely. We were, our orders were not as timely as they needed to be. We were not viewed as being responsive to the utilities that we regulate. We were not open, and our work, there was less accountability. So we do very likely say it frequently. We have been on an actual plan of improvement for the last 3 years. It was a very dynamic plan. It involved pipeline carriers and public utilities and outreach efforts. And it's really the results of that are reflected in the annual audit, which was the, perhaps the auditor can speak to it, but it was 55% of public utilities and pipeline carriers that had been through formal proceedings with the RCA said we had improved or somewhat improved in the last 4 years. So they recognize independently that the agency has made a tremendous effort to respond to what you said to us in 2003. The results of our activities are also expressed in the annual audit, where you will see that in 2000, on page 75, in 2004, we had 163 dockets pending. At the end of June in 2006, we had 101. But the dockets in the pipeline that come to us have not really substantially decreased. We opened 151, 135, and 149 dockets. So our work volume has increased, but our productivity has also increased, and we now have fewer cases in the pipeline. Yes, thank you. Commissioner Johnson.
Just on that point, in response,
we'll be fine. Okay. Just hold,
I think it's fair to say that there's a balance that has to be struck between disposing of dockets as expeditiously as we can, and also the quality of the decisions we make. And I think all of us here are very much aware of that balance and we make an effort to balance both factors in moving forward with our work. I'm very actively engaged in the case management part of what we're doing. I meet almost weekly with our ALJ staff, and we go through every single docket that we have and assess its status and where it's going in the future. So it's a continuous process we go through. That's part of it, and I think it's fair to say that it's the principal complaint, and Kate alluded to it, is in the past that the legislature has had, and they hear from the utilities we regulate, is that we don't render our decisions in a timely enough manner. And the legislature has expressed that view in the past, and the legislative auditor has been involved in that in the past, and we have tried to be responsive to that. Now, if the legislature wants to provide further guidance to us on how we strike the balance between the rendering decisions expeditiously versus the, you know, the amount of deliberation where it's involved in those decisions, please let us know. But we have tried to be responsive to what the legislature and others have told us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just make a quick comment because I don't want to take any more of the committee's time on this. But Commissioner Johnson, as Commissioner Garrett just said, 55% of the companies that you were interviewed or went through legislative budget and audit said you were doing a somewhat good job. So I expressed that part to good. At least 45% that think the other way. So with all the changes that we supposedly seen in the last few years, and I don't need any comment on this. I mean, we discussed this enough, I think. We're probably going to hear from quite a few people. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, if we get back to the CS, and again, I apologize on the amount of time you've had to study it, but if we start with the timelines, do they, at first blush, look reasonable?
Mr. Chairman, I cannot, if you would like me to go through section by section, I'd be happy to do that. Okay.
Does that work?
I think that the timelines begin on page 3, section 4. Section 4 talks about AS 4205, which is public utilities only. We are not dealing in 4205 with pipelines. So you're talking about timelines appropriate to public utilities in the state of Alaska. This change is merely a change to allow our computer system to calculate the proper number of days of 180. So there is really no substantive change to section number 4. The same is true for section 5.
Can we take a question, please?
Just pardon real me. Quick, Ms. Garrett, when I just want this for the record, because it says 180 days as opposed to 6 months. When I look at a month, I consider the weekends in that month as approximately a 30-day period. Is this 180 days, 180-day working days, or is it 180 consecutive days?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, 180 consecutive days. If it were,
thank you, ma'am.
180,
thank you,
we would say business days is the language that we would say when it's only Monday through Friday. It would be called business days.
So this is consecutive.
Correct. The next item is section 5, which again makes the change for the RCA's new case management system and merely clarifies 270 days, so there's no substantive change there. Section 6 is the same, no substantive change, as well as 7 and 8. The first substantive change on your CS, Representative Olson, comes in section 9. I'm not comfortable with section 9. It requires that the commission, as I understand it, right now the statutes that the legislature has passed under section F allow the commission to take any timeline and for one time only make a 90-day, up to 90-day extension on that for good cause. So we make a discretionary determination of good cause, and that allows us to extend for one time. What this provision appears to do is define when we can. What, and it would call into question and perhaps litigation at the Superior Court as to what is really an unusually complex and novel question of law. There would need to be a determination of what that is. So it takes our discretion and it tries to very specifically identify what our discretion to extend for 90 days means. I fear in looking at this at first blush that when we then extended for 90 days, a litigant, perhaps a party in a multi-party case, could appeal this extension decision that the commission renders and say that the issue is not novel or it is not unusually complex. The danger in that is that the law states that if the commission doesn't render a decision by the statutory timeline, the matter goes into effect by force of law. And so you open up the opportunity for the Superior Court to say, no, it's not novel, and then the matter would automatically go into effect by force of law. I think that this is particularly troubling. This was not a position that was heavily advocated or that I can recall advocated at all during the open public process that we went through. It may have been one utility sought to put this in, but this was not a provision that we had added.
Representative Ledoux.
So you're saying that somebody could appeal to say to the Superior Court to say that it wouldn't be, that it isn't complex and novel questions of law, and then if they prevailed on that appeal, what would happen?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it could be that we had improperly extended the timeline, therefore the matter could go into effect by force of law. We have only had a few minutes to look at this, but at first blush, I think that this is quite a troubling provision because of the impact that it can have. And then the attempt to clarify what our discretion is, and perhaps one of the other commissioners could also
follow up.
But the matter, I mean, there wouldn't really be a matter because the matter you're extending so that because you haven't reached a decision. So how could the Superior Court automatically implement the decision if there's no decision which to implement? That's confusing to me.
Well, I think Kate alludes to a situation where someone had taken appeal challenging our use of this new language to extend a timeline.
Mm-hmm.
It would simply create another basis for whether or not we had appropriately exercised our discretion in extending. It seems like, in my estimation, this effort to limit our discretion to extend doesn't, it further restricts our ability to act. It tightens the noose just that much more, if you will. In my opinion, I don't see where this is going to lead to better decisions by the commission. If anything, it's going to lead to decisions under pressure, time pressure, and I think there's a greater risk that we're going to do things that are unwise. So I think Kate's correct. We had maybe one party that advocated for this. I appreciate their advocacy, but I don't think this is going to produce a result as to where we need to go. But
follow-up?
Personal opinion.
Well, you may very well be right that this isn't going to produce the result of where you want to go. But in reality, as someone who's dealt with the civil court system before, it would probably take the court at least 90 days to reach a decision that you haven't, I mean, it would be moot by the time the Superior Court had reached a decision. And therefore, I can't imagine that there'd be too many appeals of the extension because you'd be extending it further to appeal it.
There is, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, if we miscalculate the statutory timeline, say it's a 180-day timeline, and we extend it, but we have extended erroneously, the law provides that matter, whatever it is that we're looking at, would go into effect by force of law once we violate the statutory timeline. And so any matter that we don't address that has the statutory timelines under 175, if we don't address them properly or timely by the 180th day, they go into effect by force of law. So this, we have discretion right now to look at our docket load, to look at the work, to look at when the parties have actually gotten to hearing. Sometimes in the past we've been brought right up close within 30 days of that statutory timeline, like on the NSTAR Marathon case recently. And we had to issue a decision on 2,500 pages of transcripts within 30 days because that was the statutory timeline. Now, if we had, we have the authority, the ability from you to extend that statutory timeline one time for 90 days. This tries to say under what conditions specifically does the commission have the authority to do that. And we believe, I believe that that's not really, that it's not a problem, first of all, and that it's not necessary.
I'm just trying to understand this. Could you give me an example of where something, it's the something that's, you keep talking about, the matter is going to go and become law.
Yes.
But if you're just arguing about what it's going to be, what's going to be law?
It through the chair, it will be a rate filing or a tariff filing, or a rate will go into effect. Or had we not opined on NSTAR's gas sales contract, that contract would go into effect by force of law. It's in Section H, and it reads, if the commission does not issue and serve a final order regarding an application or a suspended tariff within the timeline specified, then the suspended tariff or the application shall be considered approved and shall go into effect immediately.
Gotcha.
I apologize for not
Thank
being
you.
Clear.
Thank you.
What I can do, and I would appreciate it if you would do it, is give us written comments on that particular section, and I'll talk to our legal staff about getting written comments also.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that same point, the question that comes to my mind is, if the terms complex and novel can raise a flag over definition, is that true for good cause as well, or is that closely defined? So we're just changing one term for another term, either one of which might be disputed.
I think that Commissioner Wilson has the most experience at the agency and would probably be best to answer those questions.
Any extension that we do for good cause, and it's not just the statutory timelines, we have in our regulations other kinds of extensions that we do for good cause or under other standards, and at any point in time a party can challenge whether there actually is good cause. The term good cause, however, has had a lot of use over the years, and there is case law on it. There is precedent at the commission that allows us to be more comfortable with good cause than what we see in this particular language here at this time. We could, over time, become very comfortable with this language, perhaps, but it's very new, and I have not seen it used before anywhere. Perhaps the drafters got it from somewhere, and there is some precedent or case law that interprets this particular provisions, and we would love to see that if it exists. And so in that respect, if this is what the legislature wishes us to go by, this is what we will go by. I might say, however, that when we are in the heat of deciding a case and we are coming down to the wire of the statutory deadline and we are debating among ourselves over the substantive provisions, this might be a distraction in that we further debate whether the items we are debating are novel or complex. We don't have to decide that issue if we don't have this provision in there. We can simply continue with our adjudication of the real issue at hand.
Representative Ledoux.
I got two questions here. How often does somebody appeal on a finding of good cause? How often does that happen in the last, say, that's the last 5 years?
Never.
If I might, through the chair, to Representative Ledoux, I think we've conferred and we were unaware of any instances.
Thank you. Can I ask another question?
Follow up.
What's the definition of good cause? And I know for various and various legal proceedings, the definition of good cause changes. So what's the definition of good cause vis-a-vis the RCA?
There is currently no statutory definition or no definition in RCA regulations. So it goes under previous orders the commission has issued or its predecessor commissions have issued over the years. And we don't take good cause lightly. We do, when we extend something for good cause, we do state what that cause is. And the parties are able to look at our explanation of what the cause is and determine for themselves if they believe it's good cause. And it can be reconsidered. Petitions for reconsideration can be filed on it, or it also can be appealed to Superior Court.
One more follow-up. So since there is no definition of good cause, wouldn't it actually be, you know, clearer and less likely to end up with problems with people not being happy with a good cause adjudication if there actually is something which says, you know, good? I mean, basically, I mean, I'm kind of reading this as good cause means A, B, or C.
Through the chair, I think you raise a good point, and one of the pieces of information that may help the legislature is a question of how frequently do these statutory timelines ever get extended? Are we talking about something that happens, you know, when we have 100 cases, they happen 100 times, and we do report to you every quarter, actually, when we ever extend, when anyone extends a statutory timeline. And this year, on page 6 in our annual report, we published those results. And in 2006, we extended for good cause 6 times out of approximately 200 cases that we have. In 2005, we extended for good cause 3 times. And for 2004, we extended for good cause 4 times. The parties, however, can extend for good cause as often as they like. They don't need good cause. They just need to agree. They, in 2006, extended 6 times. In 2005, they extended 5 times. And in 2004, they extended 8 times. So extensions are not something that, you know, that happens very frequently. They are rather infrequent in terms of the number of cases that we have. And good cause can mean that the staff resources are limited right now, that a number of dockets have happened recently, that a number of deadlines are pending, and it's really the trust that you have in us to make a good but infrequent use of the extension.
Thank you. I know you have one more.
No, that's, I guess I'm just sort of wondering whether, if it ain't broken.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section number 10. Excuse me just for one second.
Oh, certainly.
On the previous section, and Representative Ledoux's good questions, let me go back a little bit.
Dave, could you give us your name?
Yes, I'm Dave Harbor, member of the commission. And I kind of talk from personal experience. All the statutes require that all of the decisions we make be supported by reasons. And those reasons are subject to the court's review. And so your very best barometer as to how well we're doing, including any misuse of the term good cause without stating proper reasons, would be reflected in the decisions of the courts. And the decisions of the courts have been very supportive of the commission. And I'm guessing that since the year 2000, the couple thousand dockets that have come through or more, only about 2% of them have probably been appealed past our appeal process into the courts. And of those, the court has upheld the vast majority of our decisions. We might have had a couple of remands for purposes of holding another hearing, but the report card in that area is very good. You know, the term good cause, let me apply it. In a way, that's requiring that we state the reason for why we did something, that we have good cause. But it occurs in other, we're also required to state reasons in virtually all of our decisions. And I'll give you an example, because you were trying to, looking for an example, and I hesitate to use real live examples, but let's use the example of a stipulation where you have contested parties and utilities are at each other's throat with the best lawyers in the state over a period of time before us, and that at the end of a long, contentious process, and by the wherein we have to offer due process to all of these parties that is significantly more extensive than the due process even provided in the legislative arena, that has to withstand a court appeal, that we get to the end of that process and perhaps the parties come to us and present a stipulation, and we have to find it to be in the public interest. Now, as you know, when you're dealing with, you dealt with the bargain of a gas pipeline agreement, and you heard, at least I heard you hear over gavel to gavel, that they said that an agreement, a stipulation, you can't really parse, tear it apart and analyze one part and determine that that's good and throw the other one out because it was a bargain. And so we get the same arguments before us. Here's a stipulation. You can't, Commissioner, you can't go in there and determine that every single aspect of that stipulation was in the public interest, but as a whole, we submit to you that it's in the public interest. So we have to find the reasons for it. One of the reasons that I think that participants will find frequently is when the Attorney General's public advocate is involved in a proceeding representing the public interest, and that public advocate is a party to the stipulation, that it gives some comfort to commissioners that the public interest has been represented in that bargaining process that led to the stipulation. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of insight, and I'll address, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Ledoux, item C there, the commission identifies another compelling public policy reason unrelated to the commission's workload, scheduling, administrative convenience. I don't think if any neutral party, and probably legislative audit would be in a better position to respond than I, but I'll give you just a little red flag on this one. I'm not so sure that on analysis you would find it in the public interest to say one of the reasons the commission can never use in determining good cause is its own work schedule. When you can appreciate that the workload of an agency like ours tends to go a little bit like this. I mean, there are ebbs and flows to that workload. And there are times when before us are four or five incredibly complex, important, time-consuming dockets, sometimes with one or more of the same parties. And if we were to have to abide by C, our own workload is no reason for not quickly determining good cause and closing out in the docket. If we can't extend using that as a reason, then I would suggest to you that you might have lobbyists approaching you saying, those people are not providing us with adequate due process, you know. And the other way to look at it is with constricted time frames, including the constriction that this type of a definition would put on the process, you might say, okay, we can do it, can do, because we're can-do commissioners, okay? But we have to hire the people to do it. So what happens is we hire more people to do a more constricted schedule with more constricted timelines to make sure it gets done in a tighter time frame. And what happens? Who pays for that? The utilities themselves, especially the investor-owned utilities, experience faster timelines. But it's a more expensive process, and the RCCs that you authorize us to collect from those utilities are paid by the folks. So the utilities experience the benefit of a quicker, more exciting time frame. but the folks pay for it. So right now, I'm just suggesting to you, I mean, if I saw a big problem, I'd be the first one to recommend to you that we grab that one and deal with it. I do not think that this is a huge problem, personally, sir.
Yeah, I think you hit on the crux of the issue, and that's the perception by the utilities that oftentimes the timeline is too lengthy. And again, I haven't set reset for where you're currently sitting. We had several utilities that would like to have seen these timelines half what they are. You probably know who they are because I know you were carbon on some of the letters. And amazingly enough, they weren't telecoms or energy companies. They were just simple utilities, if there is such a thing. But one of which was from your town. And what would you like to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Without saying anything, because I know how, you know, is that, what was that one a movie? It's like earmuffs, you know? I don't want to make you guys all go for your earmuffs. A pending appeal in front of you on a utility in Fairbanks, where I have agitated for a particular point of view to bring it to the attention of my community. One of the backlashes, Commissioner Harbor, that has been very difficult for me to defend is how expensive not just that utility that I was concerned about, but all the other utilities that piled on talked about time and money, so much so that they muted my concerns and accusations, were overwhelmed by their past history with the RCA. And so, newer to the process as I am, it narrowed my maneuverability on you know the unique subject matter that I was concerned with, because everywhere I turned, instead of finding an advocate for my concern, I found an adversary to the process, and it caused me to be sided against all of the good old boys of Fairbanks, who weren't weighing in necessarily on the specifics of my concerns. So good, I'm doing it, not talking about the issue. That it didn't, instead of weighing in on the specifics of my concern, they were testifying against the RCA as it relates to the other utilities that have had experience. So, you know, I'm a bit blindsided by the you know, sometimes the drafters just take the wind out of all of our sails, and so this is a good weekend to read this, contemplate it, come back fresh on Monday. I'm sure that's the chairman's intention, and I support him in that effort. But I know just from recent experience that's precisely what happened with the RCA. I thought, wow, the RCA is awesome. What a great referee. What a great adjudicator of an issue, and to do precisely what is the scope of the mission. And I was blown away by the brushback that came from other utilities in my community that looked to past performance that doesn't even necessarily comprised of things that, you know, the current RCA has touched. It goes back to the, you know, the previous incarnation, and so anyways, it's a real concern, and it has muted me from being able to express my concerns on the issue that I'm concerned about, because I have felt so much pressure against the structure and the practices, even though I'm an advocate of the RCA and of the structures and practices, and understand why it because we were, if I may, Mr. Chairman, we were just doing a bill for Representative Samuels up in Judiciary, Mr. Chair, on bail, and it went to all these other crimes, and the chairman was concerned about murderers, rapists, the perpetrators of the very worst crimes. I was concerned about my dishwashers and some of my servers and some of the people that are in my labor pool, and we were trying to make one set of laws applicable to both groups without throwing a dishwasher in jail for 25 years and not letting a murderer walk around you know, with a real lenient criminal code. And I find to some extent that this RCA tries to be one size to fit all applications and then often finds itself improperly sized for the adjudicated matter that comes or the matter that comes before it for adjudication. I think just to kind of have an open forum, I think. Is that well stated?
I think it's well stated, and Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman, if I may respond.
A few years ago, I had the pleasure of going with the legislature to Sakhalin Island and to Khabarovsk, and one of the big issues was helping the Russians establish the rule of law and through their not only their legislative process but their regulatory processes. And as a new commissioner when I first came here, as a free enterprise, conservative, backgrounded individual, what I encountered was this. The old saw that every citizen has a right to his or her day in court, and that applies to utilities. And so what happens when a utility applies for example, a rate increase, others have the opportunity, the freedom, to protest. And that happened with regard to our regulation of the intrastate portion of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Citizens, shippers, had the opportunity, the freedom, to protest. And what is the forum? The forum is here. And why does the forum exist? Because legislatures like this throughout America and throughout the free world have determined that regulating monopoly interests is not easily done by a legislative body that doesn't maintain a year-round expertise and the time to do so. And so they delegate it to a regulatory agency. And when that agency is delegated the responsibility for regulating the monopoly, it has to give the monopoly an opportunity to present its case, but also the ratepayers or other affected parties the opportunity to comment. And when that happens, when one makes a comment, the other deserves the opportunity to make a reply. And in the event that this commission did not provide that opportunity, the court system would be batting back our decisions one by one, and the legislative auditor would be reporting to you that the court system finds that our decisions lack legal perfection on a regular basis, and you would have a lot more serious reason for dragging us in front of you now. I would hope that when this educational for me and maybe for legislators process is through, that no legislator will feel mute about the ability to stand up in front of an audience and say, this is a good, solid process. It's the process that we enacted over a period of many decades and perfected. The regulations that have been promulgated by the commission have further perfected it in a public process. Every one of those utilities and pipelines had an opportunity to participate in all the regulatory processes. And what you probably, Mr. Chairman, don't often see, Representative Ramirez, is in that hearing room when one attorney will say to the administrative law judge, I've got a vacation scheduled for next week, and the other attorney agrees with me, but on the other hand, that attorney's got to go to see his son's graduation, and I've agreed with him on that, so we'd like to adjust the schedule. And our administrative law judge is supportive of the schedules because we can work it into our schedule, and then later we hear that we delayed the process. So I guess I'm here to tell you again that the court system is the very best barometer of whether or not we're meeting timelines and doing the work that you expect us to do in regulating the over 300 utilities in the state and pipelines.
I'm with you, Commissioner Harbor. You're the greatest guy. I just have such a terrific respect for you. We've had conversations, and I think the world of you, and my relationship with other commissioners has been excellent. But the pressure that I felt in my own unique experience in dealing with the RCA is $1 million. That was what I heard back was, anytime we go in front of the RCA, $1 million. And then that became the issue. rather than the concern I had was trumped by just like this million-dollar bill, that anybody who wants to go in front of the RCA, it's $1 million, and it's, and it's not appropriate to stereotype people, it's not appropriate to stereotype organizations, but often stereotypes grow out of behavioral patterns, and that's precisely the danger of them when it comes to people. Certainly is the greatest danger. When it comes to organizations, sometimes it's indicative of a pattern of behavior that's not working so well. And so the pushback I got was not for the specific issue that I was concerned about. It was, well, these guys can't afford $1 million. And any time that you put an issue in front of them, it's $1 million. And so that is certainly the private sector utility pressure that I've gotten. But my point about the murderer and the inebriate being subject to the pendulum that swings, you know, one way or the other way is the TAPS negotiation versus the some little guy who manages, who came in to see me a month ago, who manages seven or eight different phone companies, you know, that might only have 1,200 people on a service, and it seems that the size of the process is the same for the producers as it is for this little guy. That's the impression I think that the broader community has. It certainly is not the impression that I had initially with the RCA. My experience has been exceptionally positive with the RCA, but that was inside of your body. And when I left that adjudicatory process and I walked back out into the private sector, I was assaulted, veritable onslaught from all these other utilities who then complained to me about how expensive it is to do business with the RCA. And I'm that, so that's kind of where I come from, just in my orientation.
Mr. Chairman, sorry. I think we will not hold it against the Alaska legislature that you set the statutory timelines too long when the Alaska legislature sent them in 2002. The 15 months is probably too long. But what they were trying to do was establish timelines for the first time. And so they used a one-size-fits-all methodology. What happens frequently and detrimentally to the RCA, when it makes an effort to move forward into the legislative arena to talk to you about methodologies of improving process, is this the system, the effort, becomes rather hijacked, and the improvements and the efforts of 4 years and the audit report, this is incremental improvement. You are not going to change an institution or create a pipeline overnight. It takes dedication, it takes public outreach, the kind of which that involves everyone, and you too. Now, we have been rolling the ball uphill for 4 years. The five of us, and we have done a better job because it was independently verified. We would never tell you that we are done. We are 65% of the way to where this agency has the potential to be. It can be great. It can be the best regulatory. It can be what your vision of it is, but it requires your help and your willingness to understand that things are not as they should be, and to work with us. And working with us means helping us and looking at the statutory provisions that we're asking you for and addressing them in one legislative session, not two, not three, or not four, but help us, because we cannot make it better without you.
Representative Newman and then Representative Ledoux.
I almost forgot my question there. Kate, when we're, and I have just a quick question and maybe a comment for the committee. When you're looking at your docket, do you go ahead and review? I know that when I talked to one of our local utility companies, because I had some folks in my district who were complaining they weren't going fast enough, and they said, well, we take what's at the top of our list and we work our way down. Maybe there's a subdivision that's got 300 hookups for homes. maybe there's a subdivision that's got five, or an addition on a line that's got five. It's all been pre-approved. Something would only take a couple hours as compared to something that'll take a couple of weeks. Do you go at once a month, once a week, whatever, and go and look at your docket, prioritize if you can take care of some of them quick items, do that. And then a quick comment I'd like for our committee to think about is when I'm looking, and Ms. Garrett did not address Section 1, which says the governor shall designate one member of the commission which will serve as the chair. To me, that gives an awful lot of the power into the governor's seat in the fact that now the governor is also going to be selecting a gas pipeline coordinator. And we have the regulatory commission that regulates interstate, intrastate commerce. It seems to be a lot of power for the governor to have one person, particularly since his term is a 3-year term and we're talking about AGIA. What else is coming in there is that gas line coordinator. There was a discussion in judiciary as whether they even have authority over the RCA to make decisions. Something for maybe the committee to look at. But if you could express your timeline and how you prioritize.
Just the 2 points said. Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, that I think we started at the chairman's request with the timelines.
Yes,
and we didn't really deal with Section 1 of the bill as yet, the CS, so we can come back to that for sure. With regard to the timelines, mm-hmm. and I think I indicated this earlier, I meet with our ALJ staff in a fairly formal setting, and it's been proving to be a weekly meeting where we review the status of every single docket. And I can assure you that issues of complexity are always on our mind. Nevertheless, you need to keep in mind that it's not just a matter of counting. You just don't count the number of service connections or the number of customers. For example, sometimes some of the smallest and most complex dockets that have been presented to us, some of the smallest dockets in terms of their scope, the geographical scope and numerical scope is very, very small, create some of the most difficult issues. And an example of that, a generic example is when we have utilities that are failing to perform. These are sometimes, and they're posing a danger to some of their customers. We have these cases. They are small, very small utilities, but they present enormous danger to their customers. We have to figure out appropriate means to intervene. And our, once again, our scope, when we get involved in that, we're not just trying to go in and terminate the utility's certificate to serve. We're trying to solve the problem because, we have this history of a utility. They were the folks that stepped forward initially to try to serve, this small group of people. They're probably the best people to work with to see if we can make those situations work. But it's not just a matter of counting noses. But I just want to assure you, and I hope you accept my personal assurance that we are constantly assessing the complexity of dockets and constantly weighing, which ones can we address very, very quickly. We do that every single week, and I would say with every single docket.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Representative LeBeau?
Unless they would like to comment about the bill.
Pardon me?
I think the governor thing, maybe for the committee to think about this weekend. A lot of questions there.
Well, we've heard a lot of comments about the expense of RCA litigation, but I guess I don't follow how this timeline and whether or not a docket takes 180 days versus 270 days versus whether a good cause exists. I mean, whether that really plays into the expense. If something sits dormant for a while, actually, and the attorneys aren't doing anything, there's generally not too much expense, I wouldn't think. I mean, maybe there's another problem there, but I'm not sure that it's a problem with the timelines.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the a factor that substantially contributes to the cost of a case is how many parties are protesting that utility's rates. The ratepayers within the study area and the public advocate represented by the AG have the right to protest those rates. It could be that many of the customers participate, and that increases the cost of the proceeding substantially. If we merely received a rate case and then processed it through a hearing and approved it, it would be a very low cost. But it is the contentiousness and the adversary that creates the expense.
Thank you.
I think at this point in time, I'm going to, there's been some question as to what direction we're going to, and what my intention is to open this up to the public as soon as we can. I apologize again about the delay in getting everything out and the fact that we're running out of time. This is a high priority item to us as well as to you. I have broken out, obviously the bill is about 40% of what it was originally because all of the items related to staffing, to personnel, to salaries are not in it. I believe that the salaries need to be adjusted. I don't believe I'm the person to set it. Next week there's going to be a resolution that will set up a working group during this interim to review salaries, staffing, all the issues that were pulled out of the original version of 209. We anticipate that would be done in time to enact or to act on it at the beginning of next session. The next thing that would happen, that leads into the second bill that's before us today. The timeline on that particular bill is 2 years, which is, the intention was it would be more than adequate to get it past the deal, but what I'd like to do is bring up the bill just so we can get it into the process with the intention that we'll probably have a lot of written comments out of you on both this bill and the bill that we just heard, hopefully by the end of next week, and we will schedule continuing meetings as fast as we can get them into the system.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, when would you be scheduling the reauthorization of the RCA for a hearing?
The 110?
House Bill 110.
We're going to read it across right now just to get it into the system. And I would entertain a motion from somebody to adopt the CS.
Mr. Chair.
Of 110.
Mr. Chair.
As a working document.
Mr. Chair, I move CS for House Bill number 110, version 25, LS0449/M for committee discussion.
And what I would like to add, seeing no objection, we'll be adopting it as the working document. It would be my intention that when we get through the process of the working group, we have everything sorted out on the personnel side, that there would probably be another audit, and then we would go back out to the normal cycle on the extension, so none of us have to go through this painful process on a regular basis. But would you like to comment on the 2 years? I'm sure you have some feelings on it. On the bright side, it's twice what the original version was.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, and just for the record, it's my understanding that the governor supports a six-year extension. I think we should put that on the record.
I believe that the audit recommended an eight-year and that the Senate has proposed a six-year extension.
Well, I'd like to put on the record that I've, the governor's office has been in the loop on everything that I've done, as has the Senate. It's certainly open. I'm sure we'll probably see some activity on it when it comes back before us, but we've got it in the system now. And I know that you guys have some planes to catch, and we've got one more bill that I'd like to bring back for the committee that we had originally this afternoon that I don't think you guys have an interest in, but if you'd like to go catch your plane.
No, we appreciate the opportunity to come before you, to talk with you, and certainly appreciate your comments that you've made to us today. Thank you.
If we could get some written comments on 9, we'll do likewise from our legal staff.
Certainly.
Jane.
Thank you. I'm not leaving.
Oh, okay. What we're going to do is bring back the realtor's bill. We're going to delete Section 7. The realtors agree to it.
8.
Urian agrees to it.
Okay.
Brief of these. Record, and we're going to bring up the original bill.
205.
Sorry.
And I would entertain a motion to pull Section 7.
Yes, Mr. Seven. Chair. We are on, I believe, House Bill 205,
684/M version. I'd like to make a conceptual amendment to that bill, and that being to remove lines 17 through 22 on page 6 or section 7 as a conceptual amendment.
Seeing no opposition, is there a motion to move the bill out of committee?
Mr. Chair, I move CS for House Bill Number 205, Labor and Commerce Version 25, LS0684/M from committee with any attached fiscal notes or conceptual amendments.
Seeing no opposition, it moves out of committee. And we're adjourned at 5:06.